listening to Trending with Timmery, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics. National speaker Timmery Millington has been a passionate advocate for life as long as she can remember, helping Gen X through Z answer the call to true feminism and authentic manhood. Timmery holds a master's degree in biblical theology, and she covers this week's hottest stories from a Catholic worldview. You're listening to Trending with Timmery.
Hello, dear friends. It's so good to be back with you, and in studio with me, or should I say over the phone this week, is Dr. Carrie Gress, who holds a doctorate in philosophy from the Catholic University of America and has been doing incredible work talking about Our Lady within the culture today. Her most recent book, which goes by The Anti-Mary Exposed, Rescuing the Culture from Toxic Femininity, I think is truly the antidote to the crisis that so many women are facing within our culture, and finding that balance between work life, home life, fulfillment in our career, that contraception and abortion is what we need to be educated and work today. This book radically challenges the brokenness that we are feeling and the longing in our hearts as women. So don't go away. Dr. Carrie Gress is with us. Dr. Gress, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, I want to start today, before we dive too deeply into your book and the virtue specifically that Our Lady shows and how we can find accessibility to how she lived kindness, how she lived generosity, and so many of the elements of suffering and how that's fundamental to our lives as women and joy. I want to talk about Notre Dame. I was in tears this week finding out that when it was burning and just the aftermath, that I think the world is looking toward this masterpiece. What does it symbolize to you as you see this great cathedral burning?
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously so many different emotions. I actually got engaged there at Notre Dame about 12 years ago. So obviously has a deep place in my own heart. But I think that there's a lot of things going on. One of them, of course, is that church really represents her as a mother. And I think we, as people, just naturally kind of take our mother for granted until she's gone. And, you know, there are few things more sad or sorrowful than losing a mother. And so this is kind of feels like what has kind of happened on a spiritual sense, I think, for a lot of people, which is why it pierced so many of us so deeply. But I think it's also an incredible symbol. It struck me this morning of really what's happening with the church right now, where, you know, it was just, as we see in the aftermath right now, it was just really the roof that was mostly damaged, that there's part of the interior, you know, so much of it was undamaged, even right down to candles. There's wax candles that are still standing that didn't, you know, weren't melted to smithereens. And so it feels a lot like this great symbol of what's happening with the scandal within the clergy, where you've got cardinals and bishops and priests who have acted in a way that's, you know, far less than faithful. And that sort of, they burn through their credibility with their sin and decadence. And they also even see these embers sort of falling among the faithful. And yet you've got this church that's still incredibly strong for those of us who are the stones, living stones, as we're called in scripture, who are holding the church up. So anyway, I find it incredibly hopeful and a great reminder that, you know, the Holy Spirit and Our Lady will prevail despite the struggles that we're facing the church today.
I think it might be a wake-up call as well for Catholic France, that France has become so secular and anti-faith. Yeah. I mean, so much of the feminist movement itself came from France, and, you know, even travel to France has been so idealized here in the United States as part of what is that woman of success in today's world and happiness, in a sense, you know, being able to travel to Paris, you know, it's kind of the attitude we have. But I was watching it burn this week, and I just thought, I think that this is going to be a powerful moment for France, where they have this pride and joy of their culture, the cathedral. And I feel like it'll be a little bit of a conviction for so many of them.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I think that's a great point. And one of the things that was striking to me was even to see the way people that I know who are considered themselves progressive and don't want anything to do with the church, how even they found this incredibly devastating. And so, you know, I can hope and pray, we can all hope and pray, that it raises questions for them. What is it? You know, there's so much about the church that people don't like, and yet they're devastated by this, and what's that connection, what's going on there. And of course, much of it has to do with the fact that it's really the embodiment of the pinnacle of Western civilization, of what Our Lady brings when we allow her to mother us. And so it's all of those pieces are sort of working together. But I think you're right. I think we should need to pray that it really will be this wake-up call, this sense of what happens when we lose our mother. And of course, that church has been a place that has fed so many spiritually for years, and so it's an important piece of the faith and of their country.
That's Dr. Carrie Gress. I'm Timory. You're listening to Trending with Timory. I want to tie in your book. So you just had this recent book come out, Anti-Mary Exposed. And can you tell us a little bit about the title for those who might be, wait, there's an Anti-Mary? Before we get too far, and I know people are going to send in emails, just kind of explain the title and where you're going with that for those who are not familiar yet with your book.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a new word. We had to actually figure out how to spell it, the publisher and I, in terms of, you know, hyphen or not, all of that, because it's not in the dictionary. But the idea came originally to me when I was writing the book, The Marian Option. It's actually been used by other people in minor ways I found on the internet, but that didn't really come into my understanding of it. But it really just struck me that there's this huge gap between who women are supposed to be today in our culture and who Our Lady is. And it just became more resounding the more I looked at celebrities and politicians and whatnot. It just seemed clear that the values that they are espousing in our culture are diametrically opposed to who Our Lady is. And, you know, rather than thinking about it as just one individual woman and anti-Mary, I looked at St. John's writing about a spirit of an antichrist that he speaks of in one of his letters. And so I think what we're facing today is this spirit of an anti-Mary that has kind of swept the culture since the 1960s, really. But at the heart of it is this idea that both motherhood and virginity are things that need to be disposed of, and the real lie being that that's where our ultimate happiness will be, is when we can kind of get rid of those things. And I think if you look at the culture is just rife with this idea, and nothing has been more disparaged than those two things for women today.
Right. And the reality is women are less happy than they were prior to the sexual revolution. Yet at the same time, they have the contraception completely accessible and abortion accessible as they wanted. You have the ability to have that whatever level degree you want in the career. And you even have the ability to get away with such an intense personality, both in the workforce and within the home. And yet women are not feeling fulfilled as they thought they would. I mean, some of the greatest regrets we see of many popular movie stars and personalities is, I wish I had more children. I wish I spent more time at home with my family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is the amazing thing. It's just this reality of how unhappy women are. And I think we've sort of swept this under the carpet, and radical feminists have continue to make the argument that, you know, the reason we see this continued unhappiness is because we don't have enough feminism. And in fact, it's hard to say that we could have any more at this point, just given the fact of how much radical feminism controls our own culture and the way that women think. Absolutely. It's tremendous when you look at the actual details, you know, all those sort of happiness metrics for gauging whether or not women are happy. And it's just incredibly sad. That you've got so many women who are just miserable. You know, we can see the statistics about suicides and divorce rates and depression and substance abuse. All of those things really play into the picture in a way that we've swept under the carpet.
And we see that it's ultimately the children who really end up suffering as a lot of these life decisions are being made. So while the women themselves are not happy, then their children that they bring into the world are having to be on some form of medication for ADHD. You know, they're having behavioral issues within school system. Their grades are not where they should be. Anxiety, depression, eating disorders. We could go on. But ultimately, one thing that you come to in your book is that some of the primary leaders and founders of the women's liberation movement, and especially second wave feminism, are referred to even on their own as the lost girls. Can you talk a little bit to that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. No, and this was one of the fascinating pieces that kind of fell in my lap while I was writing this book. Phyllis Chesler, who's considered sort of one of the grandmothers of second wave feminism, she has written a book that just came out last fall called Politically Incorrect Feminism, I think is the title of it. And in the book, and this is something I had already stumbled upon, but she just really confirmed a lot of my own suspicions and the research that I was doing. But in it, she just underscored the fact that all of these women who were part of the feminist movement in the 60s were really women who had huge, major issues with their own mothers. Kate Millett might be the only exception. She had more issues with her father, and she was actually mentally ill. I mean, it was certifiably, she was in and out of institutions. So these women at the core were really searching for something to begin with because they hadn't been nurtured the way that they ought to have been by their own mothers. And so they're trying to fill that gap. And we know that happens just based on what you explained about, you know, children of broken people. Broken people break other people. And so we see this pretty radically among the feminists of the 1960s. And so the real goal was to try and become like men, and really, but at the same time, making it clear that womanhood was the pinnacle of creation, but the only way for women to become like men and to live out that, you know, important lifestyle of feminism that they were creating was to actually make sure that you had abortion, that you had contraception, that you didn't have children, and that the children were certainly the natural enemy. And, you know, the thinking is so skewed in so many ways. I think, you know, obviously we have 50 years of feminism to sort of see what the fruit has been, and it hasn't been good at all. But, you know, you've got someone like Germaine Greer talking about how, you know, children raise themselves. They don't need people to raise them. And, you know, how wrong she was. I think that's one of the things that we obviously have the vantage point of seeing what a mistaken notion that is. Mm-hmm. So it's incredible to go back and look at the things that they were promoting and why they were promoting them. And I was just astounded that this kind of information, I hadn't read it sooner. You know, that it's not emblazoned all over the place, and yet we're just sort of expected to think it's a wonderful thing. Even though it was coming from some women who are just incredibly broken and troubled themselves.
That's Dr. Carrie Gress. You're listening to Trending with Timory. Dr. Gress, as you're talking about this, you're appealing to a tremendous amount of brokenness that is leading, as you said, to broken people break other people. And we're facing, you know, right around the fourth generation now, in some cases, of multiple generations of divorce. And so when we're talking mm-hmm. about this story, I think part of what's really important, we're going to get to some of the power of the gospel and Our Lady and how we in our own lives, whether you're single, married, have children, wherever you're at, can really find that kind of return to our original nature and to the beauty that we so deeply long to live out in our lives. I think that it's important that we have to recognize first and foremost that state of brokenness that has crept into our own families and our own experiences and our own even formation, even if it's just by secular media today, wouldn't you say?
Oh, no, absolutely. I think that, you know, one of the things I talk about a great deal in the book is just how much of our media is controlled by elite women, this group I call the matriarchy. And so it's almost impossible to really understand an alternative view from it because we get so much from their perspective. And they've done an amazing job of making Our Lady and anything related to the church appear to be stodgy or, you know, you're going to be just the doormat or somehow incredibly unappealing. And so women just don't even have an alternative way of thinking about womanhood in our culture today.
You know, no woman really comes out of this today unscathed. I was just talking the other day about my sister. She's in high school, 16 years old. And in her history class, basically the professor asked them, you know, what are the good reasons for using contraception? Like, why is contraception so good? And so it wasn't whether or not it was important, whether it was necessary. It was automatically implying to these young people, contraception is good. It's necessary. You tell mm-hmm. me why. And so that mm-hmm. formation is there so early on. And so, and that's a big picture sexuality area, even just the way we talk to other people, you know, the desire for us women in many senses to have such a level of dominion in our own conversations and the intensity and with which we interact. These are things we need to heal and kind of overcome the mm-hmm. pride in ourselves.
Yeah. No, and I think that's one of the things that's just so remarkable about this. So there's a real, key is, of course, understanding that our will needs to be united with God's will. And yet we see everything in, you know, the rhetoric from abortion, which is, you know, my choice rhetoric, And just the way that we think about ourselves is just this activity of self-willing. It's all about what I think and what I want. And here, again, you can see really the spirit of the Anti-Mary. It's the exact opposite of Our Lady's fiat, of her yes to Christ. And, you know, ironically, what we have missed is the fact that if you want to look at the women who have been really fruitful in the culture, who have really changed the world, these are women who have aligned themselves with God's will. And women like St. Teresa, Mother Teresa, or St. Catherine of Siena, St. Helen, you know, the list is huge and long of women who changed the world. And it was because they understood that secret of, you know, associating our will with God's instead of our will being done.
I'm talking to Dr. Carrie Gress, author of The Anti-Mary Exposed, Rescuing the Culture from, yes, Toxic Femininity, as they put it. Here are all these people wearing these nasty hats at the marches. You have Kavanaugh, who was radically attacked, falsely accused. And then after all is said and done, you know, he's allowed to become a Supreme Court justice, is voted in. And what we end up seeing is a massive number of witches, which we've been talking about here on Trending, on the rise, decide to put like a hex on him, a curse on him, essentially. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Dr. Gress, you talk in your book about how witchcraft and goddess worship is on the rise. It's no surprise. Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned Madonna, Ariana Grande, Beyonce. You know, these are actually songs that we've been talking about in like a kind of different, you know, publicity sense we've seen over the years. And the reality is that even with, for example, what is it, Giselle and her Tom Brady's wife talking about how she's a quote unquote good witch.
A good witch.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, I look at this and it's scandalizing, but at the same time, it's not surprising because here we have this show on Netflix called Sabrina. And here we are seeing that one of the main characters is the, what is it, the wife or mistress of Satan. Talk to this and how it's a theme that's been going on for years in the feminist movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and this is one of the kind of best kept secrets, is the occult connection to radical feminism. And, it, you know, like, as you mentioned, it's proliferated so much. There's actually more women who adhere to Wicca than we have, than there are Presbyterians in our culture right now. So it's, And we can see this anytime that Christianity is weak and Judaism are weak, as paganism is just going to find a way to bleed itself in. I mean, if you look at history, even everything from, you know, the Israelites are trying to find the promised land. What do? They set up some kind of idol to worship. So this is just what human nature does. It resorts to this kind of thing of finding sort of an idol that fits their own image and likeness and not one that's obviously the true God. So this is why we've seen this since the 60s, actually, is the fact that there was almost this incredibly toxic blend of both Marxism and the occult, both of which I make the argument in the book have these strains in the lies of Satan and have made it incredibly explosive. But there's certainly been this huge occult element in the culture, and we've actually made it very trendy. It's very appealing. It's very sexy. It's all of these things that women think that they need to be in the world. This idea of being empowered and controlling others, because much of this really is about control and our own fears of surrendering ourselves to a God that loves us. So if we don't know that God loves us and we don't know that He is our Father that will take care of us and protect us, then we're going to naturally try and grasp onto things that make us feel like we're in control. And, you know, very few things do that better than the occult. And it's this incredible combination of things that the culture has made look just really enticing and appealing. And, you know, someone like Madonna or Beyonce or Giselle, I mean, these are obviously beautiful women, and women want that. That's what the deepest desires of their heart is that longing for that. And so that they just, because they don't have an alternative, I think this is the direction I have to go in order to find fulfillment.
That's one of the things you talk about, Dr. Gress, in your book, is how ultimately Marxism and the feminist movement recognize they had to change human nature. And that's why, you know, it was logical based on early writings of the feminists, and they outright said it at times, that there needed to be no distinction between male and female. Hence why ultimately, abortion and contraception link directly to the argument for transgenderism and homosexuality, same-sex marriage. How, What were the key areas within both the nature of women and the nature of the family dynamic that the feminist movement radically attacked?
Yeah, well, I mean, the key is, you see this both in Marxism and feminism, is this attack on the family, because they know strong families and strong women, women are the soil of the culture and of the family. Those are going to get in the way of any sort of government action. And certainly with the Soviet Union, I mean, it's remarkable to go back and see the comparisons between what radical feminists were presenting in the 60s and what socialism was already, communism really was presenting as important back in the early 1920s, 1930s. And part of that was just even this dependence, as you mentioned, upon abortion. Because women have to, you know, fundamentally their human nature had to change from being mothers, from being nurturing, to actually becoming workers. And so it's interesting to see how all of this echoing in the 1960s, even a few weeks ago, last month was National Women's History Month. And, you know, there's statements made by the UN and other places. And all that they talk about is the importance of empowering women for work and of, you know, women's choice to choose abortion. But there's no discussion about motherhood. There's no discussion about the importance of raising a child or of being a loyal and wonderful and amazing wife. Those kinds of things have by and large just kind of dropped off the whole discussion because of this anti-Mary. So it's interesting when you start digging into it, it's the same old lies of Satan. They're just sort of repackaged in ways that the culture can absorb. What's sad, though, of course, that our struggle now is the fact that the Soviets understood and saw. So these are outsiders that were coming in that were trying to change their culture, and many, many, many of them rejected it. They could see the damage. They could see, especially economically, they could see just the brokenness in their homes and their families. You have women who've, you know, had 20, 30, 40, 50, even I've heard of a woman having confessed 80 abortions in their lives.
Well, can you come back to that for a second? In Russia, you're talking about
having Russia and members of former Soviet Union.
This is something
huge numbers.
This is a piece of history, Dr. Gress, that we have completely overlooked. And isn't it something like, what are the numbers of abortions? Wasn't it like 3 in 4 pregnancies were ending in abortion? Is that the number?
Yeah, huge numbers. And actually, they were promoting it so much, and it was so successful among their what they were doing, because they were squeezing people out of the family, that you couldn't stay home with your children anymore. You had to farm it, your children out to somebody else. They made it so attractive that, yes, it actually got to the point where they had huge abortion rates, and they had to actually go back and sort of change the propaganda so that they could actually have kids, because they knew that they were you know, hitting this wall where if they didn't reproduce themselves, they were going to be in really big trouble. So, you know, China has done the same thing. So it's the same pattern of, we have to change human nature so that women aren't women. Women are more like men. And here in the West, we have just taken it on as something fashionable and beautiful and attractive and important, and not seeing the real danger of it the way that the communists did, because of the fact that it's just become so interwoven into the culture as the way it is.
We view it as powerful, and abortion is now looked at as that necessary evil. Contraception is what everyone does. Why wouldn't you be on the pill? Which is why so many people, even people who object, don't feel comfortable even, you know, maybe having a simple conversation about health reasons why they wouldn't be on the pill today.
No, it's...
Go ahead.
It's incredibly sad. And, you know, even this past week, I think it was MAC Cosmetics just announced that they're, you know, doing something beautiful, as all the rhetoric of it, by supporting Planned Parenthood. And it's just, yeah, really sweeping things under the rug, partially because so many of us in the country, I don't mean to include myself in that as a number, but I have been involved in one way or another in abortion. And so the conscience is trying to wrestle with that without facing the reality of it and really getting real healing and, you know, finding a place to actually heal that wound.
The reality.
So, yeah, it's incredibly sad.
The reality is that in your book, you talk about the ultimate answer is living as a Christian woman, and the pinnacle of human creation was Our Lady. So looking to how she lived, what she did, what the ultimate desires on our heart are, coming up with Dr. Carrie Gress, we'll be looking at what's the antidote and how can we work to live better, more fruitful, joy-filled lives as women.
Timmery will be right back. Tweet them at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timmery, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
I have with me Dr. Carrie Gress, who is the author of The Marrying Option and now her latest book, addressing the issue not of toxic masculinity, but of toxic femininity. I know I'm going to hear about this, but her new book is The Anti-Mary Exposed. Dr. Carrie Gress, it's wonderful to have you. We've been talking about some of the themes in our culture, the dissatisfaction of women, and where we can find the antidote now. So I want to talk.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for being here. Dr. Gress, I want to talk about some of the key antidotes that you touch on, but let's return to a woman's nature, because the goal of the feminist movement, Marxism, as we see in China, Russia, was to really destroy the nature of women and the nature of the family, to destroy the patriarchy, to make sure, you know, as Sue Ellen Browder, who was one of the key writers for Cosmo for a number of years, said after a major conversion to Catholicism, the two things you weren't allowed to write about for women as the Cosmo girl, if she was a virgin or a mother, which is exactly what Our Lady is. And so Our Lady is the ultimate antidote, but you talk about in returning to a woman's nature, how all women want to feel loved, do good, and be beautiful. Can you talk more to these themes?
Sure. Yeah. No, this was really one of the challenging pieces because, of course, the book is broken up into roughly two major sections. One of them is sort of the bad news and what this idea of the anti-Mary is, but I didn't want to leave it at that. And so the second half of the book focuses on who Our Lady really is and how she is this model of Christian womanhood, and she's been, you know, it's through Our Lady that we have any sense of our own dignity as equal to men in the first place. This is something that's absolutely exclusive to Christianity in terms of the fullness of it. Christ, of course, treated women differently, and we see that in Scripture, but it wasn't until the flourishing of this devotion to Our Lady that happened that we came to this understanding of why women have this dignity and why they needed to be treated so well and so beautifully, and the importance of that. So there's some irony, of course, in the fact that, you know, Catholicism is disparaged at this point as something that's anti-female, when, of course, this is, you know, kind of how we got to this place of being equal in the first place. The challenge before me, of course, was just the fact that Our Lady is so disparaged. Most people think of her as very one-dimensional. She's just kind of a saccharine statue and side chapel of a church, and it's hard to relate to her. And so that was one of the things that I really struggled with and prayed a lot about, is how do I present her in a way that's compelling, where we can actually understand who she is and what she did and what she does and how she loves us and all of these kinds of things. And of course, you know, the first thing that struck me was just the fact that everything that has happened to Our Lady rests upon the fact that she knows that she's loved by God the Father. But we also know that she's perfect. Everything that she does is going to be good and is going to be fruitful because, again, back to that idea of her will being connected with Father's. And then, of course, the third piece that was just natural, I have a chapter on each of these ideas, is that idea of beautiful. When I wrote The Marian Option, I was just struck by apparition after apparition. But people talking, you know, people that saw Our Lady said, she's the most beautiful woman I've ever seen. And even St. Bernadette said, you would want to die just so that you could see her again. She was just so beautiful. So it made me realize that these things are not incidental. They were not unimportant. But in fact, they really reflect something much deeper in the female heart. And so I wanted to touch upon those things. And you can even see distortions of these, you know, among the anti-Marian spirit of people that think that they're really are doing good. And in fact, they just have no moral compass, so they don't recognize that, you know, taking women back before it was legal to go get abortions is not objectively a good thing to do. And then, of course, even just beauty, we see how desired that is in the culture. And, you know, we obviously spend billions of dollars annually in America alone on beauty-related things. But it's not meant for us to just be sensuous or sexually attractive or for vanity's sake. There's something deeper in that. And so I wanted to go into those three parts as it connected to Our Lady and really bring those out and show that she's the fulfillment of all of these desires that we have, and not just, you know, a superficial person that we can sort of try and figure out and not go to. And the one funny thing that has happened since I wrote this book is I spent some time watching Hallmark Channel with my daughters. We were in a hotel, and we had some time to kill, so we just watched a Hallmark movie, and then we watched another one because one of my daughters got sick in the middle of the night, so we were up watching another one. And I was just amazed that here you have in those movies, I think one of the reasons why those movies are so popular is because it hits on all of these things, this idea of a woman being beautiful, of her doing something good, and of her being loved and known in there. So it's kind of really the recipe for the female human heart. We just kind of haven't tapped into it and seen it, how it's reflected in Our Lady.
You know what's funny about that is I teach Pilates. I'm a Pilates trainer as well. And I have a lot of my clients are older teachers, retired, like kind of in, you know, the latter half of life. And we'll be talking about some of those movies, like Hallmark movies, or even some of the BBC content as well. And I had, you know, people complain, oh man, it's the same cookie cutter story. And, you know, being a millennial, a lot of millennials still cannot appreciate Hallmark movies yet. And, you know, my clients, older clients, I mean, retired clients will be like, oh, you're such an old soul and, you know, you love it. And it's because I think that ultimately, no matter how long it takes you to get there, there's this beauty that we women ultimately end up reaching this point where, yes, it's the same story, but I had never seen it. It does make us feel loved. The woman is loved. Like you said, she does something that is good that makes her more attractive as well. And she is beautiful on the inside, which is where that goodness comes from.
Right. And I think the fourth thing that I talk about very much in the book, but it's that idea that we want a happy ending. And, you know, this is one of the things that Catholicism offers. And it's just amazing if you look at the numbers in terms of who are the happiest women in the world, Catholic women who are faithfully living the life of the church and who have, particularly if they have faithful husbands, those are the happiest women. And, you know, it also just points to the fact that I think much of human feminism, rather, has really been born of Protestantism, which completely is carved out of, you know, their creed, their lived creed, this understanding of who women are. And certainly Our Lady's been cut out. And so what happens again is this, because there's no place for women to really understand their spirituality and understand that beloved aspect that happens when we are united with Christ. We see that in cloistered nuns. They're, you know, that they're a model for us, but we can also see it in women who are not cloistered, who are married or single, is just, again, how this fulfillment is reached. But when we cut that out, we don't really leave any women any place to go except to think that, you know, in order to be faithful and successful in Protestantism, we have to become like men. So it's an interesting dynamic to see that. But I think, by and large, the roots are not Catholic. I think they're a reaction to Protestantism. Because when you have when the faith is flourishing, women are not malcontent. You don't see this sort of overgrowth of this, you know, unquenchable desire that I think most women are told is kind of how we need to live our lives, where we're constantly comparing ourselves to others and we're constantly focused on wanting more and having it all. And these are, you know, age-old problems that go back to Eve that we need to recognize in the church and recognize God all the answers right here.
That's Dr. Carrie Grass. You're listening to Trending with Timory. Coming up a little later, we're going to be talking about submission within marriage and maybe a little bit about what submission looks like outside of marriage as well. Hearing key insights from Dr. Carrie Grass, the author of the new book, The Anti-Mary Exposed. Dr. Grass, I'd like to talk about some of the virtues that Mary lives out and how we can start to turn toward them. And I have to say, it's hard because in many ways they're the opposite of the hardness and strength that we women are so kind of encouraged to live or have to live by living prolonged single years.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. It's hard to sort of understand what it means to be meek and what it means to be submissive and all of these things, because we don't have good role models. We don't have anyone lauding it. People, again, this is where the idea of being a doormat comes in, that's all that you can do. But in fact, we know the virtues are something that has to happen actively. Otherwise, they're not virtues. They're actually a power or a capacity. Otherwise, it's not a virtue. It's you are a doormat. So in any event, I think meekness is one of those that people don't understand at all. We generally just think that it just means that you are passively letting things happen to you. And of course, it's quite the opposite of that. It's a question of, things are happening, how do I want to respond in a way that is best for me and best for all people involved, instead of just reacting. And we've become a culture of reaction and where we think that every emotion that we feel must somehow be expressed somewhere. That's unfortunately what's happened with social media, is just this explosion of emotivism. Rather than thinking, you know, maybe there are times when I just need to be quiet. Maybe there are times when I need to listen. Maybe there's times when my opinion is malformed or I don't know all the facts. And we see this, of course, with Christ. I mean, Christ and Our Lady were obviously most powerful people in the universe. And yet they respond in a way that's in keeping with what they want to present. They're not, you know, there's this fire hose of emotions. Even at the crucifixion, you don't see this. You see them, again, tightly uniting themselves to the will of the Father and understanding that, and that's where their reactions come from, rather than it being, you know, just whatever you feel.
Do you think you could say, like, a definition for meekness? Because this is a word that is so foreign to our culture. It could be, you know, along the lines of, like, a humble consideration for all those who are involved.
It could be. I think it's more simply put in terms of just controlling your own will and your own emotions, being in control of those things. And that's by, you know, it's easy if you look at the opposing vice. Again, this idea that our emotions are, you know, should be given consideration and be aired and everything. Well, that's not really the case. We don't have to. Our emotions are actually can help inform us, but our will and our intellect and our logic are supposed to be the things that control our actions. And of course, when we live in a culture that doesn't understand or appreciate reason and logic, then the emotions are going to take over. So I think it's a complex relationship, but fundamentally, it's really the idea that we are in control of what it is that we say and how it is that we act instead of just reacting, you know, without any kind of constraint.
Timory will be right back. Tweet them at Timory. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timory.
Dr. Carrie Gress is in studio with us, providing incredible insights into how to restore femininity to our culture. Rather than, you know, we talk so much about toxic masculinity, we're not talking about the destruction that we women are doing in our friendships, relationships, and the upbringing of children today, and how from a state of really all of us have been in some way touched and impacted by the sexual revolution, whether in our homes, through media, whatever it might be. So we're talking about the virtue of meekness and how Our Lady lived this out. And Dr. Carrie Gress, I'd like to talk about, where is the strength of Our Lady to be so humble, to be so gentle, to be so generous? Where does that come from?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a great question. I think, again, so much of it comes from the fact that she knows that she's loved by God the Father. And I think that's one of the amazing keys that we see among women who are most happy is the fact that they recognize that they are loved. And, you know, it happens even on kind of a secular level without, you know, women that don't have faith, if they are loved by their husbands, and historically you can see this, there's so much woundedness in our culture today, it's hard to see it. A woman knows that she is loved, then it's much easier for her to behave in such a way or act in such a way that she's not constantly striving to get more stuff for herself. It's interesting to look at just the way that women are hardwired because of the fact that we are both physically weaker, but we also have children, and that leaves us in a place of dependency upon others for many things for so long of a stretch of our lives that just hardwired into us is this sense that we have to get more opportunities for ourselves or for our children. And so as a result, there's always kind of this jockeying for a better position or something else. And it's that kind of thing that Our Lady didn't do because she knew she could rest in who God the Father was and he could provide for her. And I think that's one of the pieces of peace that Our Lady offers us and, you know, models for us is this idea of rather than feeling this agitation and this wrestling and this restlessness that we feel like we're constantly need to get more or change things or do more, be more. We have this sense of, you know, I am cared for, I'm loved, and I can rest even in these circumstances that may be less than ideal or may not be perfect. And so I think that's one of the things that's so remarkable. But again, it's this idea of she knows she's loved and she knows the will of the Father, and so she's able to do that rather than launching out on her own and thinking, let's try this, let's try that. kind of grasping at straws that we see so much of in our culture.
Yeah, she's able to do the good that you say women so deeply want to live out. So she's able mm-hmm. to do good because she knows she's loved. She's coming from a place of unconditional love that only God can provide.
Right.
And that creates a beauty within that elevates our sense of self-esteem. You know, we might have a mm-hmm. poor sense of self-esteem on the exterior, but a lot of the time it's more so because of what's going on interiorly with ourselves.
Yeah. No, and I think that one of the places that I have drawn a ton of inspiration that has just fascinated me to no end is to look at what men write about women. What is it that they love about women? And you see this, you know, definitely a pattern. I looked at, you know, 2,000 years of poetry and music, and really this pattern emerges of a woman who's self-possessed. She is patient. She loves people, and she helps them become better people. And there's this archetype of womanhood that we see throughout mythology and elsewhere that talks about a woman. A woman is compared with a vessel of sorts, whether it's a ship or an oven, you know, something that holds others. And I think this has become for me a really great way to start thinking about womanhood is how do we hold others and in a way that they're made better? We see this in our biology. So it's not, I'm not making this up, but it actually has a sort of theology of the body or a sacramental element in our bodies. I mean, we have wombs. The way our arms are shaped is different than men, such that we can hold a child and cradle a child more easily than a man can. So all these things point to the fact that women have this deep capacity to hold others, and in that holding, whether it's thinking of their needs, whether it's praying for them, whether it's providing for them on a very physical level or providing for them on a spiritual level, this is one of the great secrets of what women do, is we hold others. And you can even see this in, you know, all the references in scripture to Our Lady pondering these mm-hmm. things in her mm-hmm. heart. Well, she's clearly praying about things, clearly trying to either savor things but taking them into herself. So I think that's one of the fascinating elements that I haven't read a lot about elsewhere, but it was just amazing to sort of think about it in a new way. And this is what men are responding to, is this idea that women can sort of contain them and help calm them and bring peace to them and joy and fill their needs in a way that's loving and uplifts them and life-giving instead of something that drags them down and makes them feel worthless.
And I love how in the book you talk about how all cultures had different types of language for women that encompassed the embrace, the holding that you're talking about. And some people might hear the term, you know, ship, vessel, oven in reference to women mm-hmm. and kind of think, oh, like utility, women are just being used. But it wasn't mm-hmm. utility. It was an all-encompassing love that gives life just like our body does, that mm-hmm. physically nourishes. And ultimately, you know, I think St. Edith Stein talks about how, and there's a quote directly from you in the book at one point, very similar paraphrasing almost, where it talks about women are called to essentially like nurture the divine spark in other souls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we transform them. We have this capacity when people encounter us to either lead them astray or to transform them into something better. And I think that's one of the things that we haven't paid enough attention to, is this ability that we have to love them into a better place and gift them with these things that we have within ourselves. So I even like that image of an oven, because of the fact that you put something in and when it comes out of the oven, it's dramatically different than when you put it in. And I think these are just helpful ways. They're obviously, like you said, not meant to be utilitarian or to see us as objects, but to show that. And even the nave of a ship, or the nave of a church, is referring to this idea. You know, we call churches she, especially in the Romance languages, it's always referred to as she and in the feminine. And part of that is because there's something about going into a church. Again, you go into the Mass and you come out, you're slightly different, or maybe sometimes a lot significantly different than when you came in. But the word nave mm-hmm. comes from navy, from ship. So it's all kind of connected and, you know, not just in mythology, but also deeply entrenched into Catholicism as well.
That's Dr. Carrie Gress. You're listening to Trending with Timmy. We're going to have you on again soon, because in a second I want to talk about your key insights into what living submission looks like in marriage, because I think it's something that we don't know how to live, and people always say, like, what does this look like? But before that, you were talking about how ultimately women in this language are meant to, you know, build up, nurture, send things out, right? That's what our bodies do through motherhood and nourishment. But how you talk in the book, and I think this is a really key insight for so many women to remember, that we're not supposed to form those people to then be dependent on ourselves. And this is what a lot of women are doing. Mm-hmm. They're shaping, whether it's their children or spouse or other people, to need them rather than shaping them to go out and be mm-hmm. strong, functioning human beings to impact the culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and this is one of the things that was so striking to me is that there are two ways in which women can go wrong. One of them is neglect, and the other one is manipulation. And, you know, the woman in the middle, if we can look at those two as the extremes, edges, the woman in the middle, she's the one that basically works herself out of a job when it comes to her children, that she is has the capacity to tend them, nurture them, cultivate them in such a way that they don't technically need her anymore. Obviously, they're still going to love her, but they don't need her guidance. They don't need her, the apron string, so to speak. And that's really the goal, is to help create and help nurture people into very functioning, healthy, mature adults, because it's only when we have spiritually mature adults that you can actually have a healthy society. So I think that is an incredible piece that we have to understand and remember and look at when we're trying to figure out how it is that we react in our relationships towards others, mm-hmm. is that model of recognizing their individuality and helping that come to its fullness.
We have just a couple minutes left. I want to hear some key insight from you on the topic of living within marriage, the virtue, truly the virtue of submission to your spouse, mm-hmm. especially in light of your mm-hmm. book. What can you say to this for those who are struggling to find what that looks yeah. like?
You know, I think the hard part is the starting point, because by and large, we have been told that men are idiots. If you look at any commercial that's on TV, it's usually a white guy who can't, diaper a baby, or he can't buy a car without a woman. And I think that if we're going to start with that starting point, we've already sort of defeated ourselves, because men need and desire to be respected and uplifted. And when they don't have that, they give up. Because men, their natural vice is laziness. Women's natural vice is trying to grab more. So you can see this dynamic that happens with a couple where she's grabbing more. She's trying to take his authority, his final authority. And I have an amazing husband, and we talk a lot about mutual submission, but I'm always grateful that I know when push comes to shove, there'll be times when I say, I'm leaving this decision in your hand. But again, it's that dynamic of trying to figure out how a woman doesn't overstep her boundaries. And there have been instances where, my husband will say, well, if I say this, then you're going to react that way. And I realize, wow, I've overstepped this boundary, because he thinks he's shutting down in this area. Mm-hmm. So I think it's obviously every couple is different, but I think one of the crucial points is women just need to understand that their love is going to lift and edify men. And without that, that's just going to kind of sink his personality. And there just can't ever, that balance is hard to recreate. So she feels like she needs to grasp and take over more of his fear, and he keeps descending lower and doing less and, becoming more and more passive. He's that guy on the couch, with the remote control, rather than feeling that he has a place and a purpose. So I think that those are mm-hmm. because it's so personalized, I think those are the first two starting points that we have to look at in our own relationships to try and find that perfect balance.
Incredible insights coming from Dr. Carrie Gress, the author of The Anti-Mary Exposed, Rescuing the Culture from Toxic Femininity. You can find her at carriegress.com. And I have to tell you, it's a page turner. It's an easy read, but has profound insights into femininity and what we so longly search for to live out as women.
This has been Trending with Timmery. To book her to speak or learn more about her guests, visit radiotrending.com. That's radiotrending.com. You can listen to more of Trending via the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or the iHeartRadio app, where you can share your favorite episodes.